I mean, when have you ever hired a drummer just because he's got a degree in drumming? It's exactly. Not how you hire people.
Welcome to Don't Give Up Your Day Job, the podcast, the only podcast you need. Yes, I know, I'm doing an intro. I haven't done an intro for ages because I got sick of it. And it's time consuming and I have always felt awkward talking to myself. I don't know how other podcasters do it. I'm perfectly comfortable talking to someone, but talking to myself seems weird. However, this is our 150th episode. So I thought I'd better say something. Mainly, I just wanted to say thanks. Thank you to all of you for tuning in, for listening, for sticking with us, for, you know, giving us your time. There's a lot of content in the world, and the fact that you click on this and give us a minute is really genuinely appreciated. The only reason why I do this and why the people that help me do this is because we believe in it and we think it's important and we think transparent conversation is necessary, arguably more so these days than ever. And we get great feedback from everybody, and the feedback is really important to us. It really motivates us to keep going, or motivates me to keep going. It makes it worth it. And I know that's something that people say a lot, but it's real and it's heartfelt. Thank you also to all of the guests who have been on the show. It's more than 150 because we've done a few shows where we've had more than one person. So I don't know how many people have actually been on the show. I'll take a guess at it being around 170, 180 maybe. And it's funny because in the early days, I remember thinking, I wonder if we're going to run out of people to talk to. Surely there's only so many, you know, professional creatives we can talk to in this country. We might get a couple of years out of this and then run out of people to talk to. And yet I have a list, I have a spreadsheet of people I'd like to invite on the show that I keep adding to all the time. I added a few more names yesterday. And so far, I haven't run out. Turns out there's more creative professionals than I thought. And it's always amazed me how open they are and how willing they are to really talk about their experiences and the reality of their experiences. I was always someone who wore my heart on my sleeve and spoke pretty openly and honestly, often to my detriment. I often landed myself in hot water, but I thought that that was a quirk of my personality because it certainly set me apart in the immediate situation I was in as a kid. But I guess it's an entertainer thing. I guess it's a creative thing because the people we've had on the show have been incredibly open and honest, and it's been great. And it's hopefully been really helpful to everybody listening. And this episode is no exception. I've never met Fiona McDonald before. I've loved her music since the 80s, I think, was probably the first time I heard her. And this is an example of, you know, she comes over, we say hello, we press record, and this episode happens. What a privilege it is for me to be able to sit down with people like Fiona and shoot the shit and joke around and talk about the art of business and the business of the arts. So thank you again for tuning in. I really mean it. And thank you for tuning in the future. Can I call this an advance thank you for future listeners? Does that make any sense? Well, I'm going to leave it there anyway. Now, if you do like this show and you do genuinely think we're doing something useful, it would be really helpful and very much appreciated if you could share it. And that could be a social media thing, you know, literally share it on Facebook or whatever. Or it could just mean message a friend and say, hey, have you heard this show? Have you heard this podcast? There are a lot of people out there trying to figure out how to build a career in the arts. Also just build a career in general or start a business or something like that. And hearing other people's stories, I've always thought was incredibly valuable and helpful. A lot of my ideas in my career came from reading books and autobiographies. Podcasts didn't exist back then. So I read autobiographies like Charlie Chaplin's autobiography, had a profound effect on me. Richard Branson's autobiography, also just biographies like Chris Bork's book, Something So Strong, which is the story of Crowded House, that really had an impact on me. But these days we have podcasts. I mean, books are still great, by the way. Autobiography's fantastic. But podcasts are great because we get to talk directly to people who have actually done it. And that's what we're trying to do. So if you think this might be helpful to somebody to just expand their mind, we're not selling answers. We're not trying to convince people that we've got answers. We're just talking it all out. and trying to expand our perspectives and our ideas. And if you feel so inclined, please feel free to share it. So today's episode was really fun to record. I had a great time talking to Fiona. It was a hell of a lot of fun. Again, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for everybody's support and contribution over 150 episodes. Thank you to Fiona McDonald for joining me on this episode. And here we go. So I went to his studio in LA and we did the whole episode and we got to the end and it was a really funny episode and we had a great time. We got to the end and he turned around and he goes, "Oh shit." And I said, "What?"
He didn't push fucking play.
He didn't press record.
Record. Oh my fucking God.
And but he was gracious enough to say, "All right, why don't you come back in a couple of days? We'll do it again."
Oh my God, but you can't replicate those initial responses.
You can't repeat the conversation. We sort of tried because we had a really funny conversation about weed and things like that. So we sort of tried to go back into it, but then you basically spend the whole time going, "Remember when we said this?" So it was classic Greg moment.
So now you're in control of the fucking record button.
Well, I try to be when I can be. Graciously, it's all coming back to me now. He drove up way up into the valley, went way out of his way, because as you probably know, he's in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And he drove a long way and came and did the whole thing again, which was cool. And it was great. And it was I think even the second one was probably better.
Okay.
So it worked out.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that you'd been in a band with him.
Yeah.
Until I did a little bit of research.
Yeah.
And that was called Diatribe, is that right?
Diatribe. And was he in Seven Deadly Sins as well? Fuck, I can't remember.
How far back does that go when you were working with him?
So I was about 19. So that's, hang on, I have to do the maths. 1965, 1975, 1984.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yep. Mm. So it's before Headless Chickens before
years
everything.
And years before everything.
Yeah.
Diatribe was my first band.
Right. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did you meet Greg? Was he, did you just meet him through the band?
Oh, we're recording.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay.
I haven't forgotten this time.
Yeah. Okay. So I was at BFM as a, volunteer DJ. Mm-hmm. And I must have been singing around the halls, and so they found out I could sing, so I started doing radio IDs, BFM Uprising, for the breakfast show, etc. And I think at that stage, I'm not sure, because Greg did a little bit of DJing up there as well, but this guy, it was actually Rafa Rao Jokey who formed the band. He's Meta Tamita's son,
right?
The film director. He must have heard the jingles and wanted to find out who I was, and I just joined the band through that.
Yeah, that's cool. I was trying to work out the other day how long BFM had been around, because for some reason...
Oh, 70s?
Is it that far back?
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I thought they were it started in the 90s for some reason.
No.
I mean, obviously...
It started as Radio Bosom.
Radio Bosom?
Yeah, what? It was called Radio Bosom, obviously run by a lot of guys.
Right, yeah.
It was called Radio Bosom, and that's where the B comes from.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Radio B, then I think just got Radio B, and then when it went from AM to FM, it was BFM, which is sometimes just called Bloody Fucking Marvellous, but that's why Radio Bosom, yeah.
That's blown my mind.
Yeah.
Wow. So we actually vaguely have Bosom FM.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
not that
crazy.
Obviously, not that the younger generation know about it.
But do you know, was it always a student station? It was always what it is.
Yeah.
Cool. And so it's like, am I right in saying it's been 19 years since the last album came out?
Yep. So the last Straw People album was No New Messages.
Yep.
In 2004.
Right. Yep. And why now? And also, why not wait another year so that you can say 20 years?
Ah, look, from the way we were writing, it could have been another bloody year. We've been writing for this for the last 8 years.
Really?
Yeah. I'm 58 this month.
Yep.
And we started talking about it. Paul Cassidy and my birthdays are a few weeks apart.
Right.
We started talking about it at our joint 50th birthday party.
Right. Yep. Okay. Yep. And what was the trigger at that point to get back into it?
I think we both had been thinking about making more music.
Mm-hmm.
So at that stage, it's only 11 years since.
Yes.
Does that sound better?
Yeah.
It had only been a decade.
And we'd both been thinking about making music. I mean, you know, I'd had children. I had deliberately decided not to do any more music. I didn't want to be a tragic fuck who kept on eking out bad, mediocre music to a increasingly non-interested public.
Yeah.
So I just decided very consciously to stop.
Right.
And I didn't envisage I'd come back to music at all.
And was that decision more of a, just the way that you were looking at it, or was that an outcome of things happening that made you feel that way?
No, it was me consciously deciding. Right. I mean, I wanted to have children.
Yeah.
I'd done a few albums with Straw People. I'd done an album with Headless Chickens. I'd done my solo album. I wanted to have children. I'd kind of had enough. I think at that stage, I just had enough.
Right, yeah. Yep.
I wanted to do something else. I went overseas for a few years. Lived in London, came home, had some children, came home and got involved with TV presenting, which I loved just as much as music. I mean, not just as much in one way. There's a passion for music that nothing comes close to, but my enjoyment factor was just as much. I did a series called, I was a judge on New Zealand Idol. I did a show called 10 Years Younger. I did three or four seasons of that. And I loved presenting. It kind of ticked the box of the, you know, show off in me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What, the entertainer in me.
What, one of the ones I wanted to ask about was the TV2 series At Extra.
Oh, see, I wasn't going to mention that one.
Oh, really? Oh,
is that... Okay. So that was my first.
I haven't seen it. I haven't watched it again.
Well, I don't know if anyone did see it except my dad, probably.
But I love the premise. What it was about, basically projecting what the internet was going to be about, right?
Yes. So that was my very first foray into television.
Yeah.
And it was on a Sunday afternoon, about 2 p.m. No one. I don't know if anyone saw it.
Right.
We had an expert. I can't remember his name, but he knew everything about the internet. And then we had me, who knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
So I played the same role on the big art trip about art. There was an expert in art and I'm the novice. So this was, okay, I do have a funny story. So I'm going into this show to talk about the internet, the WWW internet.
Yeah.
And this guy's trying to teach the, and it was all funded by Telecom because it was At Extra.
Right. Yep.
And it's their domain and to try and teach the public, this is the future. In the process of me doing the show, they gave me a computer just to borrow for while I was on the show. And I got this big hulking computer in my apartment.
First time you had a computer?
Yeah.
Yep.
And I look at it. I go, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
Like, I had no idea.
Yeah.
What am I going to use that for?
Exactly. Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
So it kind of sat and it made that old, you know, but I don't think I used it. I just looked at it. And then a few years later, I get a job working for Touchdown as a casting as a researcher casting director.
Right, yeah.
And now I'm using a computer. I hadn't used a computer before this stage. Now I've got a computer and, you know, I'm just thrown in the deep end, which was great. And there's lots of lovely people around me. And I get this email and there's a part of it that I do not understand. So I ring up my very dear friend, Jude Anaru, and I emailed her and I said, Jude, there's this paperclip thingy. I don't know what I'm meant to do with it. What is it? I did not know what an attachment was.
Right.
I had no idea. So, yeah, I went on a steep learning curve.
But do you remember some of the content in the show? You know, do you remember the projections? Because one of my favourite things to do, do you remember that TV show Beyond 2000?
No.
You don't?
No.
I think it was an Australian show, and it ran through all of the 80s and 90s, and it was all projecting about future technology.
Yeah. And what did they say?
Oh, so many things. Like every episode had about five or six different things that they talked about. And there's a episode, it's all on YouTube, so I love watching it, just to figure out what they got right and wrong, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And one of them was, there's quite a lot of stuff about music players and mediums and things, which of course they couldn't have imagined the digital age, so they were just basically, their CDs were getting smaller for most of them.
Oh, right, okay.
There was a really funny one that, before GPS came out, there was a really funny one about navigation where you basically called a number and they said, where are you? And you went, I'm here. And they went, okay, go down the road and turn left.
Ah.
Personal
navigator.
Yeah, because they didn't know that GPS was around the corner, you know. But then there's other stuff that they actually got surprisingly right.
Cool.
So I wondered if you had similar memories about the conversations.
No, I don't. It was more sort of explaining what the internet is,
right,
how it works, where it's come from, mm, this is what you do, this is what you can find. it was quite pedestrian.
Right, yeah. I mean, I remember quite clearly, I think it was in 98 when I was at a friend's house and she was talking about the internet. And I said, what is the internet?
Right.
And she said, oh, I've got it, like, have a go. And
so
she,
when was it?
When did it start?
Yeah, what year was it?
I think it kind of blurred into existence, because I think the internet has actually existed for decades.
It wasn't used. It was the military,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
they
yeah.
They had hooked up their
That's
computers.
Right. Yeah. And I think maybe in the universities in the States it was being used in the early 90s.
Ah, right.
As a way for scientists to communicate with each other, yeah, or something like that.
Right.
But for my personal experience, I was slightly late, because I didn't have a computer in the same place I lived until about 2001, I think.
Yeah.
And it was because I was dating a girl who was living with me, and she was at uni, so she had a computer to study. And I was like, I was kind of the same as you, like, what would you use this for?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I discovered, like, bands had websites. And I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I can go and find out about,
like,
those.
MySpace.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I always liked lots of bands that weren't that popular here.
Yeah.
So I was able to go and find out about these American artists and so on, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, for me, it was actually quite late, but I think a lot of people were maybe 98 maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, because at the time we had no idea what the impact of the internet was going to be, or the digital age. We were worried about Y2K, which of course turned into nothing. All these years later, now we're on the forefront of AI, and it's almost like we're having the same conversations again. What does this mean? And we're all, I mean, I don't know what you think, but I'm sort of torn.
I'm torn, but I'm more because historically of exactly what you say,
yeah,
I'm more open-minded and positive about it.
Right.
Like, I wondered, like, I've used ChatGPT, mm-hmm, you know, I think a lot of us have now, and right now it's a blunt tool,
mm-hmm,
but it's definitely a useful one.
Yes.
Like, for example, I had this idea for a children's book, a children's picture book. So I put in the premise of my idea, and I thought, I wonder what it will spit out.
Right.
And it spat out a very badly written, clunky, you know, story.
Yeah.
But what it did show me was that, and I said, make it 750 words. But what it did show me was, I think it's a great editing tool, because I went, aha, I've got all the structure of the story there.
Mm.
I've got the arc of the narrative of a children's picture book.
Right.
So now I can go in and write it. Like, right, I can use my creativity and actually, without plagiarizing anybody, I can write my book. Like, yeah, it saved a lot of time in, like, here's the structure of a story. And then I wondered about lyrics.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, the next time I write a song, am I going to put a few lines of, like, I'm not interested in plagiarizing anyone else, but I did wonder about plagiarizing myself. So I thought, shall I put in some lyrics from different Straw People, Headless Chicken songs in there and say, write in this style about this.
Right.
And see what it comes up with. Am I just going to be fed a whole lot of, am I going to recognize my own lyrics? Because there they'll come up in front of me and I've written them all, but it's a new song. Well, you know, I wondered what would happen. So I just think it's an interesting tool.
What was the outcome? Did it sound? I haven't tried it. Oh, you haven't tried it. Right, right.
I should.
Because now I want to try it too.
Yeah, no.
I want to know what a computer thinks my style is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when they did, like, a few months ago, they did that thing with, I think it was Drake and The Weeknd.
Right.
And they did that song and it sounded just like them.
Mm.
And that's where I drew the line. Like, as far as someone putting in my lyrics and coming up with a song, like, how would I feel about that? I don't know that my lyrics are that unique or special that I would go listen to a new song and go, oh my God, they've ripped me off, you know? I don't know anyone who's that unique, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure. But, no, you got me thinking. Who in the world is that unique at writing lyrics?
Well, you know, maybe someone like Tom York or Ian Curtis. But then I thought, if they took my voice, if I heard a new singer that sounded like me,
yep,
and I bristled at that, because it's kind of very intimate, your own physical features, like ripping off a style of writing is one thing, but ripping off the way I sound, that, like, when I listened to the Drake and The Weeknd song, I was like, oh my God, I'd be fucked off if someone sounded exactly like me, was making money off essentially my voice. So in that respect, I think artists have, anybody, a painter, whatever, has to protect their own copyright, for want of a better word.
It's a good point, because obviously the Hollywood strikes right now are...
That's exactly what they're trying to protect.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know if they're talking so much about the audio capture of their voices. Are they talking about that at all? Do you know?
No, I think I don't know, but they're talking about the way they look, right? Yes. They'll just But I mean, it's all part of it. If you're going to get someone capture Harrison Ford's voice and have him doing a voiceover for a movie,
right?
I mean, we'd just fuck him off, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's Harrison Ford. It's unique to him.
It's completely unethical. What concerns me is that technology has already come along and had detrimental effects on industries, like the way that the music industry has been affected by initially piracy and then streaming. It's clear as day, but no one cared.
No.
So, I mean, and it comes back to that, how do you regulate the internet thing, which has always confused me, because there is awful stuff on the internet that we do regulate. Mm. So why can't we regulate piracy or other things like that?
Come on. It's money. Come on.
Am I being naive?
Yeah, probably. Look, I just had this discussion with somebody the other day, and I was like, you know, Spotify, of course, at first I was, because I've had this thrown at me before.
Mm.
You should just be doing this because you love the art. You shouldn't be worried about the money.
Yeah.
And I'm like, exactly, fuck off.
Exactly.
Of course I love it because of the art. Of course it's a deep passion for me. How do you want me to do my craft if I can't pay for food?
Right.
I'm exaggerating. But, you know.
But the point stands.
The point stands.
Why should we get penalized because we like what we do?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when Spotify first happens, I was like, for fuck's sake, here we go. It's absolutely free. Now, many years later, do I use Spotify? Of course I do. Do I love it? Yep, it's great.
That's the thing. You can't put it back in the box now.
No, can't put it back in the box. Yeah. Yeah. But I have this to say about it. There's a really good positive thing about Spotify. Someone who listens to this podcast can go in and straight away check out Straw People. Never heard of us.
Yep.
They can go in and discover all of this music, which is me being in their living rooms, and I never would have been in their living rooms, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yep.
You know, my son is introducing me and my daughter introduced me to bands I've never heard of before and soundtracks, and it's amazing. The negative side is, like, I feel like I'm drowning in the music. I used to feel like I was on top of everything.
Right.
Now I feel like I'm drowning. I've got a bit of FOMO of, what am I missing out? I've given up on thinking I can ever catch up.
Yep.
It's like, you will never catch up, Fiona. You will never know all the bands I'm missing out on in this song. You know, a lot of music I get into now is, this conversation is segueing left, right and centre, but it's through soundtracks.
That's how it works.
There was that Dark show. Did you ever watch The Dark, a German show called, Dark? Or just Dark?
No, I don't think so.
Oh my God, I watched it twice, straight after. I just watched it all over again.
Wow.
A lot of, Agnes Obel, is that her name? Anyway, a lot of music I discovered through that show, because I'm watching it, I'm Shazamming
That's
it.
That's what I do.
I'm liking, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, good, I don't want to forget this.
Right.
So let me find it right now.
Yeah.
It's a great show. It's about, I won't say what it's about, but it's intense and it's clever and it's intriguing.
Right,
Where was I? Oh, Spotify. So, yes, get into people's lives. Now this is what gets me about Spotify. I can't give you the facts and figures. You might know more than me. But if you say that you've got 1 million streams, it really does not equal a lot.
That's right.
Of money, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, I don't know what we're talking about. Let's just, for the sake of the argument, call it a few cents.
Yep.
Let's call it a few cents per listen. It's probably not even that much.
Right.
Why don't Spotify keep, obviously we can't put it back, right?
Mm-hmm.
They've got Spotify, Apple Tidal. They've all, the technology's out there. Here's my suggestion. Why don't they just pay the artists better?
Right.
To me, it's quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
And even if today, and okay, Taylor Swift and et cetera might be making, you know, millions. So let's not have an argument of, well, Taylor Swift doesn't need any more money, or The Weeknd doesn't need any more money. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
And they might support this as well. Let's make it the bottom 70%. Mm-hmm. Let's do a graded scale.
Great idea. Yeah.
Let's do a graded scale so that those people who are making millions, fine, they're fine. The artists like Straw People and new kids on the block who are getting 500 plays, whatever. Why don't we grade it so that if we doubled it tomorrow, I'm still not making any
money.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not, if we doubled it.
Yeah.
If we tripled it, I'm still not.
I did listen to one guy who was, I can't remember what his job was, but sort of an expert in that field, who made the case that the streaming model can't work. Like, to supply all of that music to the public and then charge a monthly fee, you would have to charge an extraordinarily high fee to be able to pay the artists anything sensible.
Yeah.
So he said the actual model's broken right from the start.
Yeah.
So while I agree completely with the logic you're saying, I don't know if it would actually work out in the maths. You know?
Yeah, but who's making the money?
Yeah, yeah.
Who's making the money? We know the rich artists who are right at the top of their game are. Yep. I understand that. Mm-hmm. I want to know how much money Spotify and their shareholders are making.
Exactly.
That's what I'm talking about.
And why is there a lack of transparency in regards to the contracts with the streaming agencies? Because I went to one of the aggregators and said, quite in the early days, can you give me the breakdowns of what we earn per click? And they said no. I said, why not? And they said, we've been told to sign a non-disclosure. And then I spoke to another guy who worked for a record company who explained that some of the bigger artists have got different deals to the rest of us. So that's why Taylor Swift was initially complaining about it, and then she went quiet. And I think they just paid her out, basically.
Right.
So I think the big because the other question I had was, why did the big labels put all of their back catalog up onto Spotify? When they were making so much money on the back catalog, and then they put it on Spotify, I think they're getting different rates to independent artists.
Mm.
So it's pretty corrupt all the way up, you know? And then,
And it's not like you're going to stop artists making music, because that would be cruel.
That's
and
right.
It would never happen, because if people need to express themselves, they need to express themselves.
Yeah.
So it's just, once again, it's an example of where had someone been more empathetic and more wise and more spiritual about it, wouldn't it have been, and why do we use the word naive? I was about to say, well, that's naive, Fiona. Why is it naive?
Right.
Why isn't it just fair?
Yeah, yeah.
Why can't Spotify make a shitload of money because it's their idea?
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the big artists make a shitload of money. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy. But just, just make it fairer down the bottom of the pool.
Yeah.
It's achievable. They just don't want to.
Exactly. It comes down to that basic life ethic of don't be a dick.
Yeah. Don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
Very wise.
Why do the people at Spotify have to be dicks?
Yeah, they don't have to be dicks.
And I've got the same question about all sorts of different things in terms of climate change and corporations and just
don't
stop
be
being a
dick. Stop being a dick.
Yeah. So writing and releasing an album after,
Oh, that's where we were. Where it started.
I like to do very, very abrupt segues.
Yeah.
It's my style. So writing an album after, some years have passed and some life events have passed, how has that changed your lyric writing? Because the new album, which I love, by the way.
Thank you.
The new album feels heavier to me. It feels more profound. Like, it feels like there's a depth to it.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the reasons for that is that we... obviously, it did take quite a few years to make. We discovered early on that Paul Cassidy and I really just wanted a session to last about 2 hours. That was about it.
Right.
And then we were kind of done. We're just tired. Our brains have been used up.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had children and work, and he is a producer on 7 Sharp, he's very busy. And it was once a week.
Right.
And I think we got to twice a week.
Wow. Yeah. Right.
Amazing.
Which also explains why it took so long.
That's why it took so long. But also, we were under no pressure. We at that stage, it was just he and I who knew we were doing this. And because there was no pressure, we were like, let's just find out if we can even write music anymore. And if we can't, we haven't told anyone. Doesn't matter. So we went in and we started. And I have to say that I very consciously thought about the why was easy. I wanted to.
Yeah.
Does anyone give a shit was an interesting question. Mm-hmm. What relevance do we have is an interesting question. What music are we going to make is an interesting question. So I did consciously think about these things, and Paul and I kind of did discuss them in vague sort of terms. And then we just decided to write music again. And it did take a few months of like, how do we do this again? What do we do? Where do we start from? What do we do? So we're getting loops up. That's how it usually starts.
Yeah.
He'd already been working away a little bit for a few months with Matthias Jordan, the keyboard player from Pluto, and by himself. He'd had some musical beds already up, which is a few songs. The Sleepwalker, Second Heart, are examples of that. Then we started writing songs from scratch. There's a song of mine, Watch You Sleep, which was from 25 years ago. It was a song that didn't make it onto my solo album.
Sure.
Thank goodness, because it's much better now.
Right.
But no, there was talk of that. What are we doing? And so, but we just stuck at it. And then by the time we got to, aha, that sounds good, we were like, okay, we know where we are now. And then we just kept going. And because we had all this time, we would work on songs, we would let them sit, we would come back to them, having not listened to them, and we would know straight away what we liked, what we didn't like.
Yeah.
We kind of, I think the word sculptured is a good word. That's what we did with the songs over a long period of time.
I'm curious to know how you solved that question, or how you answered that question of, does anyone give a shit? I feel like everyone in the arts is asking that question these days. It's just harder and harder to get anything to land anywhere. For someone like myself, I haven't experienced some of the stuff you've experienced. So I wonder, does that question feel different because you have been a household name, you have been in these very popular bands, to now be releasing music in the new world? Facing that question, is that a different dynamic for you to face than it is for me, who was never a household name?
I think it's probably makes it easier on me and harder.
Mm.
There's further to fall if it's shit.
Right, yeah.
But there's the comfort of knowing you have a fan base, you know?
Yes.
That you've already touched people's lives and there's many years of it.
Yes.
Did I think people would be interested? Yeah, I did think people would be interested when it came down to it, because me, as being, you know, probably the main singer of Straw People, but not the only singer.
No.
Me as a fan of Straw People, I was interested. Right. I wanted to hear more music by the band. So, and by the time we got to where we thought we were making interesting music, we were just trusting our own guts and trusting each other. Paul and I bouncing off each other are like, well, if we like it, other people are probably going to like it.
Exactly.
And at the end of the day, it was just like, let's just do what we want to do.
Yeah.
And we certainly were not writing with the idea that commercial radio was going to play us, because we knew they wouldn't, and they are not.
Right.
No.
That's criminal.
Having said that, you know, we've had spot plays on various stations, and Hauraki have been, you know, lovely. And BFM, the student network, I don't know. They of course, are going to show some interest, but it's, you know, 20 years down the track. I mean, this band was born in student radio. The first EP was made at BFM. Mm. So we're definitely a student radio band, but it's 20 years later and a lot of those kids have never heard of us.
Right, yeah.
So, but anyway, what I was saying about the writing of it, we didn't have to worry about. We just had to make music that we liked.
I guess in some ways that's a freer process,
isn't it?
It's
beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
I mean, that's probably one of the upsides these days, is that you don't have to really, I mean, like, you know, the old idea, well, it has to be 3.5 minutes long, otherwise it won't get played. It's like, it won't get played anyway.
Yeah.
Just make it 8 minutes long.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we're sort of artistically more free now because... Yeah. Who cares anyway, you know?
Yeah, and I also hoped that, you know, knowing the beast that is social media and knowing how Spotify works, I figured that, honestly, all Paul and I cared about was that our fans, basically, I don't like the word fans, that people who like our music in New Zealand and Australia and maybe further afield, you know, we write this album and they get to hear it.
Right.
That was it, really.
Yeah.
And we figured that through Facebook and Spotify, we would get the word out enough that people would know it was there.
Yeah, yeah. And do you, and my comments before about the album feeling heavier and more emotive in a way, does that, do you think that's just my experience, or did it feel like that for you guys?
No,
too?
It feels like that for me.
Right. It reminds me of, I can't remember the name of the album, but the album of Peter Gabriel's with Digging in the Dirt. It reminds me a lot of that,
right?
The moods on that album, and some of the sounds.
No, it is a darker feel. Like Knucklebones is kind of poppier, Sleepwalker's dreamy, but no, it is, and it just is. I think the instrumentals make it a bit lighter.
Yeah.
I think it's funny because, you know, it's taken 8 years to make this one. I've already started writing the next one in my head because hopefully there'll be another one.
Yeah.
And I really want to go. I really want to go pop. Maybe because, you know, that album was quite cathartic. And I really feel like writing pop songs at the moment. Really want to write some pop songs.
Would that mean like more upbeat, dancier? Do you mean pop in that sense?
Yeah. And my idea of pop, you know, the pop that I love or that I can see myself doing, there's like that, I think you're right, it is a deeper, darker, moody album.
Which I'm saying in a good way. Yeah. I love it for that reason. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So do we.
Yeah.
It's got a melancholia about
it, you know?
Which is beautiful because, you know, it helps us get in touch with our feelings,
right.
Have a bit of a wallow, then go out and have a bloody brioche. but, you know, my favourite kind of pop, like the pop that I would really friggin' love to sing, I've got a few favourite pop songs. One is Justify My Love by Madonna.
Oh, yep. Mm-hmm.
And Can't Get You Out of My Head by Kylie Minogue.
Kylie Minogue, yep.
And I love that bloody Papa Dumb song of hers.
Right.
Have you heard the new Kylie song?
No.
Oh, my God. It's
check it out.
So infectious. I love Bad Liar by Selena Gomez.
Oh, yeah.
I love... there's a few pop songs that have something hypnotic about them I love. Give me a hypnotic pop song, and it's pure pop. Like, Justify My Love, I know it's downbeat, but man, it's a pop song.
I've never gotten on board with that anti-pop thing that some musicians have, you know? Because, like, pop music is basically everything that came out in the last 100 years, really, isn't it?
I know. I think there was a period, like, with sort of the 80s music, with, you know, the advent of punk rock and then new wave music, a scorning of pop music. If you think about how berated ABBA were,
right?
And ABBA they're some of the best songs that will ever be written, and
absolutely,
they're incredible songwriters. I was a big I was Agnetha, obviously.
I often talk about ABBA as an example because I've never been a fan of them, and I sort of, my default position was I didn't like them.
Yeah.
But then I had to learn to play a couple of their songs for a couple
of
gigs.
And how hard was that?
Well, they weren't hard to play, but they were just so brilliantly written.
Yeah.
I was just, this is genius. And then I realized, like, it's the way that I frame it, there's just some things that aren't for you. You know, and like,
you can not like something but still appreciate it.
Right. Like a kid's toy, like My Little Pony, not really targeted to me.
No.
It's probably fine if I don't like My Little Pony.
It's okay.
But it's perfect for some people.
Yeah, you don't have to hate My Little Pony just because you don't want to play with it.
And you don't have to accuse it of being, that's
exactly
bullshit. That's not, you know what I mean? So
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Hey, parents. It's hard to raise a family and keep costs low, especially during this cost of living crisis. If you're looking for a way to save on your kids' clothes and toys, look no further. Replay Thrifts for Kids is here to help. They sell quality secondhand branded kids' clothes and Montessori-inspired toys. Not only is it great for the wallet, but it's better for the environment too. Check them out at www.replaythrifts.co.nz and give them a follow on Instagram at replay_thrifts. I also have this memory of probably the first time I became aware of Headless Chickens and Straw People was in the very early 90s sort of period.
Yeah, when we were out, right?
Yeah. And I remember that time in music just being just so potent. There were so many amazing things coming out. Like, especially in about 1990, 1991, it just felt like the doors were blowing off and just one incredible album after another.
There were a lot of great.
Yeah.
Was a lot of great music.
In all genres, too.
Yeah, you know, in
rock and roll, there was, like, obviously Pearl Jam, Nirvana, and there was all the Guns N' Roses stuff and all that stuff coming out. But, and Blood Sugar was 91, I think.
Mm.
But you just go, you look into R.E.M. I mean, not R.E.M. That's also awesome.
Yeah.
But I meant to say R&B.
Yeah.
Look into the R&B world and hip-hop and just everywhere. It was just, it was such a potent time in music. I don't know if you've done a deep dive, but recently I did a big Google on all of the albums that came out in 91, and it just blew my mind.
Really?
Yeah. It's like every week, a legendary, groundbreaking.
I wonder what was in the water at
that time. Know.
Something.
I mean, obviously the industry was still in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It was just this ridiculous time in music.
Yeah. What you said about the industry doing great, I wonder if record companies were just being a bit free with a checkbook on bands they might not like previously have invested in.
Yes.
You know, being a bit more adventurous.
I feel like that's true. I feel like my understanding was that, you know, a lot of stuff didn't work. You know, my understanding was that a lot of signed bands never recouped.
Yeah.
But the ones that did recoup were making so much money, and the back catalogue was making so much money that it was kind of like, that's kind of the model.
Look,
that's why
the Headless Chickens thanked Kylie Minogue on the Body Blow album.
Is that right?
And that's because we figured that Mushroom, because we were signed to Flying Nun, but that was through Mushroom Music, the Australian record company. We figured that Kylie's success led to them investing in us.
Right. Yep.
So we decided to thank Kylie.
Yep.
Because we think that is why.
That makes sense. Yeah. That, I mean, I think that's completely true. I think that's how it worked. Yeah. You know. I did notice actually. I made a note here that you went through a few different record contracts. I put it in order: Pagan, Pagan, Epic, Columbia, Columbia, Epic, Epic, Epic / CRS, Big Pop.
Yes, well, yeah.
That's just a straw people.
Yeah, that's just straw people.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Mainly you can cut that down to Pagan.
Yeah.
Sony.
Right. Oh, okay, Big that Pop. Wasn't in there. Okay.
A lot of the Epic stuff, that's all Sony.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, right, yeah. Why did it keep changing? Was it just...
That's sort of the record company's business more than ours. That was the record company side of things, not
I see.
Not straw people shifting from... It was basically Sony. Whenever you see Epic, you can think Sony.
Gotcha. Yeah. Right, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, circling back with my very abrupt segue again,
yes.
Back to the lyrics.
Oh, lyrics, okay.
There were some lyrics on this album, for example, in Paper Cuts.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know if you like to talk about where lyrics come from.
No, I haven't. I don't intend to talk about it, but you can ask me.
Yeah. Oh no. I mean, I mean, the line that stood out to me was, "So punch me, kick me down, and beat me, stomp me on my face," and I know. I straight away, I loved it. No idea what you're writing about.
Yeah.
But again, there's so much. I just love music that says something, and I feel like a lot of music that comes out these days just doesn't really say anything, you know?
Yeah, look, I love Paper Cuts. I think it's kind of like if I think about George by the Headless Chickens, it's kind of like my next song like that.
Yeah.
It was interesting. The lyrics were far heavier. The song, I think it's a great song. Mm. The song almost didn't make it on the album because the lyrics were a lot heavier and Paul Cassidy, it was too heavy for him and he was like, no, it's, I just...
Like too dark, do you mean?
Yeah, the original lyrics.
Yep.
And he was like, yeah, and he wanted to tame it down and then I was like, yeah, I don't want to tame it down. And I said, okay, I'm going to take it back.
Right.
And then time it again because we had all of these years, time went on. My heart healed a bit.
Yeah.
And I came back and went, if I don't put this song out with straw people, it's not going to come out.
Mm.
So by that stage, I had a bit more perspective on it and I could see there was still power in, I let myself have another look at it and hear what Paul was saying.
Right.
And I could still see how it worked. And I think it's great. I think it's kind of, in a way, because it's more restrained, it's kind of more powerful because it leaves a bit more to the imagination. And we, with that song, we wanted to, it didn't quite work, but we really wanted to kind of Donna Summer.
Oh yeah.
Those particular words. We wanted to make it a real kind of pop thing, to make the darkness of those words be just juxtaposed with it being really pop.
Yeah.
Didn't quite get there. I still like that idea. And I think the song is perfect the way it is. Yeah. I think it's just great.
I love it.
Yeah.
I also love your rhythmic approach to a lot of the vocals on the record. They really have a strong kind of syncopated feel to them a lot.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah.
but I was actually for that song. Have you heard of an artist called Goldfrapp?
No.
Alison Goldfrapp. She's English.
Okay.
Her surname's Goldfrapp, but she just goes by Goldfrapp. Have a listen to her first album.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfect.
Right.
It's perfect in a way that Dummy by Portishead is perfect. Mm-hmm. Or Massive Attack's first album, perfect.
Yeah.
There's a way, I was very influenced actually by her for that song because she has a way of singing free form and with wailing. And I don't know if anyone else noticed, but for me, this album, like I've really, no one else has, I haven't talked about this, but I really wanted to sing in a different way in this album. And Paper Cuts especially, I just wanted to fucking feel the words and just whatever came out, like, a lot of that I didn't consciously, you know, write the melody. I was just like, okay, I'm just going to go in and sing it. And so I did take after take after take and we pieced the bits that we like together. Because I just wanted to get into it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it worked because it does have a more of a soulful feel to it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it translated to me that way.
Cool.
Is the reason why you don't like talking about the meaning behind lyrics, which I also relate to in my own way, but I'm just curious of the intention there.
There's two things.
Yeah.
One is that it keeps my story private to me.
Sure, yep.
And your own story will invariably involve other people, and I don't wish to expose anybody else.
Yep.
But also the bigger question for me, or the bigger thing to think about for me, is that lyrics belong to the listener.
Yes.
And I don't want to... I remember Michael Stipe from REM talking about one of his songs, because pre-Green, mm-hmm. pre the album Green, I was such a big REM fan, absolutely a devotee, and he talked about, I think it was The Perfect Circle, which was one of my favourite REM songs, and he talked about it, and it just blew it for me.
Right, yeah.
I was like, that's not what I thought the song was about, and if Michael Stipe wrote it, and he's telling me what the song's about, I kind of lost my version of the song.
Yes.
I've forgotten what he wrote about it, and it's okay, because now I listen to the song and it's all good.
You got it back.
But yeah, I got it back. Yay! Yeah. But I don't want to do that for anyone else.
Yes.
Like, you know, the Paper Cuts is a good example of a song that can be very cathartic in the same way that George Hedda's Chickens or You Ought to Know by Alanis Morissette.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to take that away from anyone. You get your own friggin' story and you bloody sing along and feel better afterwards.
Yeah.
You know?
I love that. Yeah. And I kind of assumed you would say that.
Mm.
Yeah. There's a song called Nails on My Feet by Crowded House that has always been that type of song to me.
Which album's that off? I'll have to listen to
Together
it.
Alone.
Oh, okay.
It's got this lyric.
Nails in my feet.
Let's see if I can remember it. The lyric in the second verse is, woke up the house, stumbled in sideways, the light went on and everyone screamed surprise. And that one little bit has just haunted me ever since I first heard it. The idea, because to me, what the image that I paint is that the character is in a terrible state.
Yes,
is often must be drunk or something.
Yes, correct. That's where I'm going with it.
Yeah,
yeah.
And is in a really dark headspace and is now stumbling through the door, thinking fuck, like that. And then the lights come on. It's like a surprise party.
Yeah,
and all your friends and family are like hooray, and the conflict. Of the darkness and the love.
Yeah.
To me, that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
No idea what he actually wrote about, and I sort of don't want to know.
No, I think it's good not to know.
That's right.
Yeah, I feel that very strongly about Don McGlashan, like he's just been inducted, and he is my favourite New Zealand songwriter.
Yeah,
I have great respect for a lot of New Zealand songwriters, and they're way up there, but there's something about Don's writing that just puts him a bit above everybody else.
Yeah.
He's my favourite, and there's a lot of his songs, and I do not want to know what he's written about them, because they haunt me. They haunt me as well.
Yeah.
And I go into this world with his songs and his music and his melodies and the way he shifts chords around, and I'm transported, and it's very intimate. It's very private.
Mm.
It's my relationship. I remember going to see Blam Blam. Was it Blam Blam Blam? See, I'd never seen Blam Blam Blam, one of his first bands, because I was too young. And then I went to see them, I don't know, maybe it was The Other's Way or something like that. But one of the songs came on that was my song, my favourite song.
Right.
Everybody else is reacting the same way I do.
Yeah.
And I was jealous
of
that song. No, I wasn't jealous of the way they were responding.
Mm.
I was jealous, like I was jealous, the true meaning of the word jealous, to be protective of.
Right.
I was jealous of that song.
Right.
Excuse me, but I have that response to the song. Why are you guys feeling the same way?
Yeah.
I have this. So, yeah, it's a very intimate relationship.
But isn't that also great? Like when you're really into a band and really into their songs, and then you go and see them live, and this thing that's felt like it was just you, and then you look around and you realize that all these people are having the same experience.
I agree that possibly I would feel like that the second time I went to see them. Blam 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 don't play very often. So the first time I was just jealous.
Yeah.
Maybe the second time I could get over myself enough to then enjoy the camaraderie of it.
Right.
But
no,
I did not experience that.
Do you write lyrics with that balance in mind of, I don't want to be too literal, but I don't want to be too abstract, and you sort of try and write in the middle so that it can be... It can belong to the listener the way we're describing.
No, I don't consciously write like that at all.
You just
No, I just write for me.
Yep.
And, I mean, Paul and I write lyrics together. Mm-hmm. Some of them are just mine, but most of the time it's Paul and I writing together.
Yep.
So there's a bit of sharing there. And we're really interested in, I think, we do like mystery.
Mm-hmm.
We do like ambiguity. I think that sometimes, like, for example, Second Heart, we wrote those lyrics very, very much together.
Mm.
And I have an idea of what that song is in my head, and I'm sure he's got his own idea in his head, and we haven't shared that with each other.
Right.
But as we're writing it, we're talking about, you know, we want to sort of go into this world, and it's about loss, and it's about memory, and it's about, you know, so we talk about it in broad terms, and then we create a world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just want... Just want a world for people to dive into and float around in.
Do you remember the song Desert Rose by Sting? came out like 20 years ago,
no,
or maybe
I don't.
A bit longer.
Just another. I'm gonna have to text myself these names. What was the other song you said? Oh, it was the Neil Finn song. Yeah,
yeah. Nails on my feet.
Yeah.
Desert Rose has, I believe his name is Cheb Mami, who is French or maybe from the Middle East somewhere. I forget where he's from, but he doesn't speak English at all.
Yeah.
But he's a really popular singer wherever he's from. Mm. And so Sting asked him to join him on the song as a sort of a duet. So Sting has the song and he's got his own lyrics, and he says, he says through a translator, do whatever you want, write your own lyrics, just feel it, do your thing.
Yeah.
So there's a bit where Sting sings and then there's a bit where Cheb sings, and then it kind of alternates. After the fact, they'd finished recording it, it was all done, and it was a massive hit, by the way. And it's beautiful because he's got this incredible style of singing.
Desert Rose.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. It was also a bit of a breakthrough. It's a famous song because it was the first time that they really how does it work? It was one of the first times that they blatantly used a song in a commercial and unabashedly just went, we're making money. I think they used the song in a Jaguar commercial.
Oh, okay.
And Jaguar, they used the footage in the music video as well. So the music video is Sting like driving through the desert.
So they went, fuck you, we're doing an ad.
We're making some fucking money. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. And it was
Spotify.
Yeah. And, well, it was
not that Sting needs the money.
No. But yeah. I think it was around 99 or something. And that whole commercial selling out idea was still in the air.
Yeah.
And so Sting just went, fuck that, I'm making money.
Yeah.
And it was a massive success for Jaguar as well.
Anyway, you're going to go tell me something about the lyrics.
So the lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for keeping me on track.
That's all right.
And so after the fact,
yes.
He then said through the translator, what did you write about? And the buzzy thing is he wrote the same story. He wrote the same story on accident without knowing what the story was by just feeling the music.
What was the story?
I can't remember.
Fuck, I want to know now. I want to see the translations of it.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
It'll be on the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Just go and see it at Extra.
I didn't expect follow-up questions. So in terms of the production of the Straw People, and I suppose this also relates to the Chickens as well, at the time, I always felt like that you guys were so different. And sort
Which guys? Both of us?
I guess both bands,
yeah.
But probably Straw People more so, were so, they just seemed so different to me, and innovative was the word that I was thinking.
Mm.
It's almost like, and I went back, of course, and had a listen before you got here, and it's like since then, loads of other artists have done similar things.
Mm.
But it's all, to me, and I'm trying to work out if I'm right, basically, it feels like you guys were doing this sort of thing first.
Yeah, no, we were.
Yeah.
We were doing it first.
Right.
And when I say we, not me.
I realise it's a bigger team.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, and there's a crossover between the Headless Chickens and Straw People because Mark Tierney from Straw People produced the first Headless Chickens EP along with Rick Huntington at BFM.
Yeah.
That was born in BFM as well.
Mm.
And so people like Rick Huntington and Mark and Michael Laurie from the Headless Chickens, the keyboard player, this is pre-sampling. So they would get sounds and record it and cut them up and loop them in that way and get sounds and do it very old school.
Right. Still with tape, I assume, right?
Yeah. And they would get the four track, and they would cut it up and tape it up, and so it was incredibly innovative. I mean, I'm sure Brian Eno was probably doing exactly the same thing.
In a different way, yeah.
There's probably a few bands, well, obviously, we were. It's just like the first Portishead album, I think, was that 1994, 95? Anyway, first Straw People was like 1984?
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, it was. And,
But
we were.
Do you feel like it was a plan? Like, we're going to do something different?
No, I don't think it works like that. I think you just get curious about things and the technology's there. And this is how things get invented, don't they? You go and you go, fuck, I can do this.
Yeah.
Have you heard this? Shit, we should do this.
Yeah.
Let's go and tape a rusty swing.
Right.
You know, I'm in a playground, I hear a sound. Wow, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
Let's tape that.
But people are so so commonly just stuck in their ways, you know, and musicians are really good at being stuck in their ways. So is this just a really open-minded group of people in these two bands?
I think it's probably with both bands, there were technically minded people involved. Like, if you go back to the Beatles, I think this is true. I could be wrong, but listener, Let's just pretend I'm right. I think it was John Lennon.
No follow-up questions.
Yeah, no follow-up questions. What was the name of, is it Brian Epstein? Is that the name of the...
The manager?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the producer. Who's
the producer? George Martin.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know who it was, but I think it was John Lennon and that came up with the idea of chorus vocals. So there is an effect called chorus, and what it basically does, I know you know this, but I'll just explain for people.
Yep.
It makes something sound thicker, and it makes it sound like there is two of something happening.
Yep.
So if you think of something that is mono and it's only one channel, and then you've got stereo and there's two channels, you can have, I sing double up, triple up, four times, you know, I will sing the same line seven times to get a thickness and to get a choral effect. I think it was John Lennon who went, I'm going to sing the same line twice and see what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So, well, that was invented then.
Yeah.
You know, so there are these little things that happen all the time, or they got a, you know, they decided to, I think it was the Beatles, that they were so experimental.
Oh, yeah.
They decided to tape the distortion coming out of the speaker and use it, you know. So I think what happened was with you know how things are so sped up and you think, what's going to happen in the next 5 years? And now it's like, what's going to happen in the next 18 months?
Right.
I think it reached a point in terms of technology and the way we were using it that instead of just going, hey, I might sing this line twice and come up with a chorus effect, it was like, whoosh,
right,
let's tape some swings and we can do this. And so it opened up a brainstorming of ideas that quickly just became like a spider web and opened this door. And then the next thing that happened was the sampler and sampling loops and all of that. So I think it's that they're lucky that those bands are lucky to have Mark and Paul Mark Tenney and Paul Casserly, who are interested in that, and Michael Laurie from the Chickens, to be those people that were curious.
Right, yeah. Mm. I love learning about some of that historic stuff. Like, I can't remember where I got this from, but I think the double-tracking thing that John Lennon was doing was partially almost from an insecurity. Like, it was a way
of his voice.
Yeah. I don't think he was that confident about his pitch control. And so double-tracking it, of course, sort of evened it out a bit, you know?
Oh, really?
I believe so, yeah.
Because that's interesting, because when I realized that, I went back and listened to it. And, like, when I'm doing a chorus effect, it's like, you know, it's perfect. I'm singing exactly the same way. He didn't.
No.
And it's beautiful. Yes. Like, the imperfections of both the voices has got a warmth and a humanity about it, which, you know, which perfection doesn't give you.
Right, yeah.
I'm still not going to sing out of key so I can get the infection, but you know, the way he sings it, you can hear the different voices, and it sounds beautiful.
It's similar to Hendrix was really insecure about his voice,
right?
And he used a trick that he pinched from Dylan, who I think was also insecure about his voice, and the trick was, and I think this makes sense, because I you know, back then they wouldn't have had stage monitors, so they could never hear themselves.
Right.
And as I'm sure you know, the tail of the note is usually the hardest bit to land, right?
So you just cut it off.
So you just cut it off.
Oh, is that what they did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why he went, hey, Joe.
Ah.
You know, heard you shut your mama down. And he sort of spoke the last word.
Ah.
And I learned that in a book or something, and I've pinched it. And
yeah,
I,
and totally.
Whenever
cut
I'm struggling to
Can't
hear my.
Yep, stop singing.
Just talk the last
just
word.
Just stop.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
And I love how that. And that's now become the sound of Dylan, and it actually became the sound of Hendrix.
Yeah.
I don't know if many people have actually noticed the similarity between the two.
No, I hadn't.
No, I think that might be the only similarity, but still.
Yeah.
I love learning about some of the abstract ways those things come into play. Mm. But sort of more to your point, what fascinates me about the Beatles is that they had no point of reference.
They had no point of reference.
They were literally making it up.
Yeah, they were. But also, if you think about when they started getting really experimental, they'd made quite a few albums, right?
Yes.
They'd been in the studio. Those guys, they made so many records.
Mm.
So you can understand where they was probably just a bit friggin' bored.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh, geez, can we just try something different?
Although, you're right. Like, by the time they started experimenting on Revolver or whenever they started experimenting, they were probably like album 6 or 7 or something. Although, they made their entire catalogue in about 7 years. Or 8 years.
Yeah.
I think the first time they were in the studio was either 62 or 63, and the last time was 69.
All over Rover.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is amazing.
And like, in the last stretch of albums, every one of them changed the world.
Well, it's lucky they didn't wait 19 years between every album, isn't it?
Well, it worked out for you guys. Nice segue. Worked out for you guys because the new album's brilliant. Obviously, we're talking about you guys being innovative back in the early days. Is that something that you still try and think about these days? Can you even be innovative these days when there's so much stuff out there?
Yeah, no, I don't think we were trying to be innovative. I mean, there's a sound of Straw People that Paul Paul and I both really like. We really like the way Still People sounds, and we just wanted to do it again.
Right.
So for us, it's always going to be electronica heavy. It's going to be, it's usually strings. Strings didn't really feature much. Horns actually featured more this time around. It's usually strings.
And who played sax? Because it's beautiful.
Nick Atkinson.
Oh, it's Nick.
From Supergroup.
Yes. I've been wanting to get him on the show for ages.
Oh, you should. Okay. You know, he's a lovely man. Have you met him?
No.
Oh, he's one of the kindest, loveliest men.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy. So, you know, he came in and played sax. And
I was a huge fan of Supergroof, but that stood out to me straight away on listening to this album because his performance in your album is so, how would you describe it? It's really smooth and it's very soulful.
It is soulful.
Yeah.
Well, that's the great, when you've got great musicians, because, you know, Straw People is a village.
Mm.
It's a village to make a Straw People record. And so you get musicians that you trust and admire, then you don't try and tell them what to do. So
right.
You just said, just come in and play.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that sounded beautiful.
And is it still a village after all these years? Or is it now?
No, I think the village has got bigger.
Really?
Yeah. Right. The village has got bigger. I mean, I would love, like Matthias, I'd never met Matthias, and Matthias Jordan from Pluto has been a friend of Paul Cassidy's for a long time. He and Paul and I co-wrote three or four songs on the album, but he wrote them with Paul first, and then I came in and did my thing. We didn't meet each other until just a few months ago.
Right.
Well, he's my music brother now.
Yeah,
he totally is. And awesome. And if there's another, when there's another Straw People record, I want to write songs with him.
Yeah.
He's a freaking genius.
Excellent. Yeah.
And it's like the influence of, say, someone like, you know, Chris Vandergeer from Stella, the guitarist from Stella. He engineered the Vicarious album. So our relationship with him goes back to then. And he and Joost Langbeld, who is a bass player. Chris and Joost run Big Pop.
Yes.
This is through Big Pop. Joost Langbeld and I were in a band together many years ago called NRA, Four Headless Chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Joost played bass on Trick with a Knife.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationships go back many decades. So their opinions on this album were not just from being, because they're the record company, but because they're people whose judgment and taste we respect and admire.
Right.
So, for example, Watch You Sleep was a song that I first wrote 25 years ago.
Mm.
It changed dramatically when I worked on it with Paul. And then Joost Langveld, he's a co-writer on the song, because he walked in and he said, how about we have a wall of bass at the end of the song?
Right.
I went, fuck, that sounds interesting. So he wrote this amazing bass line, and then he played it many times.
Mm.
It completely, completely changed
what
that song was. He wrote that, nothing to do with Paul and I.
Right.
It was his idea, and it transformed the song, and it's made it so amazing to me.
Yeah.
I was just in awe of this idea.
I love that. I mean, you know, when you demo something yourself and you play everything in yourself, no matter how hard you try to make it interesting, it's so one-dimensional and it's so narrow creatively. Mm. As soon as you get more people involved, just different personalities and different influences, the whole thing opens up.
Yeah, you can think you wrote, like, I could have said to myself, I wrote that song 25 years ago, it's my song.
Yeah.
It's not my song.
Right.
It's not my song when Paul comes in and does this and that and this and that.
Mm.
It's not my song, it's our song.
Yeah.
It's not our song when Joost comes in and does that. You know, I think a lot of songwriters can get really precious about it's my song and blah, blah, blah. It's like, shut up. Okay, fine. You know that idea you don't want to credit that songwriter for?
Yeah.
Take it out then.
Yeah.
And don't have it in your song.
Right, yeah.
Then find out how good your song is.
Yeah.
It's like, can we just make, I'm just like, let's make an amazing song.
Yeah.
Let's make it. And surely, you know, the more people's ideas you have, the better.
Mm.
You know, Chris Vandergeer was instrumental in making Knucklebones work.
Yeah.
We struggled with that song. We didn't know what it wanted to do.
Really?
Yeah, no, it just wasn't kind of flowing. And then Chris came in and went, blinkety blink blink, and he waved his magic and he made it work. So again, this is the value of us having so much time. You know, we could have thrown Paper Cuts out, we could have thrown Knucklebones out, but we had the time to just let them ferment.
And I have the luxury myself of working with really good musicians, and I've always thought it was a crazy idea to get into a situation where you're able to work with really good musicians and then micromanage them. You know,
yeah, don't
I mean,
do that.
The musicians I work with are so good that whatever ideas yeah. they come up with will be so much better yeah. than what I try to think of for
yes,
the drum part or whatever. You know?
I'm catching out in my own hypocrisy now, and some of the musicians will go, Fiona, you do too. But what I like yeah. to do is, like, if I've got ideas for bass parts or saxophone parts or whatever,
yeah.
I just want the musician to do what I want first.
Right.
So I can, in my mind, I can shut my own mind up.
Yes.
If I've got what I want on tape, then I can relax and go, okay, now do whatever you want.
But I don't think that conflicts with it.
No, I don't think it does.
I think
too.
That's just working the idea through.
Yeah, it's just, I just yeah. want to hear the idea yeah. so I can let it go.
And also so that they can understand the initial concept. So
oh,
that,
yes,
so
you're
that,
good.
So that they can.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's why I do it.
Yeah. And then they can go, actually, that's good. Let's leave it as it is or let's develop yeah. it. Yeah. yeah. I don't
Damn
know. To, I mean, I guess we've all worked that stuff out over the years, you know, yeah. in different bands.
Yeah.
I've been in situations where I was accused of being too, like, it's got to be the way I wrote it. And I probably was at certain points in the past.
That's a learning curve.
That's
though.
A learning curve, yeah. Yeah.
It's
and
all
then,
learning curves.
And then you realize along the way, like, oh, for me, I guess it was in experiences in studios where I would lose the argument. And then afterwards, that would be my favorite bit.
Absolutely.
And I'd be like, oh, wow, that's interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And then there are other times that I actually regret not holding my ground as well. So.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think what I came to the realization was is that an idea is just an idea.
Yeah.
It's just one.
Mm-hmm.
Like there might be something, I don't know, there might be a big idea where I go, I want like this vocal to be, I want it an octave up and an octave down.
Mm.
That sounds like a really strong idea and something I might not give up on. But otherwise, like, there's so many ideas. When the song is out there at the end, nobody knows that there used to be a triangle in that section. No one yeah. knows that there was, you know, there was a clarinet there. No one knows.
Yeah. So, I also think what's really important, this is one of the big lessons I've learned, is that recruitment matters big time. So if you're working with people when you're not really that into their playing style, or if you've got conflicts with them personally, that's going to be a lot harder. But if you're like, you know, I'm a big fan of the people that I work with. Like I really love their playing.
I couldn't imagine working with someone. Why would you work with someone you weren't a big fan of?
Well, I think for me, I don't know about you, but for me in the early days, you put a band together with whoever you could get.
Oh, no, that's true.
Yeah. So
and that's
like,
a learning curve.
Do you own a bass? You're in.
Yeah, yeah,
you
know? Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
yeah.
Can you play the bass? Doesn't matter.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Just stand there.
Yeah, this one I said to my son recently. I said, your first band, just join it.
Exactly.
Just
yeah.
join it.
And that is awesome because you yeah. learn so many things by doing that.
Yeah.
But if you genuinely like the people you're working with and you like their playing style, and also if everyone's into it because they care about it, you know.
Exactly.
Then it you might get into a moment about an idea, but it's never personal and it's never.
No, it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
No. That's what the Chickens were quite good at that. It's kind of like we all had a vote. But the main songwriter, which is usually Chris Matthews, he would get two.
Mm.
And also, if someone kept arguing and got passionate about it, like we would, if they were sort of stomping their feet enough, you'd think, okay, well, this is important.
Yeah.
And we might not quite get it, but, and that's the respect thing.
Because
it
means something to
yeah,
them.
Yeah, it means something. So yeah. we got to
especially
have
if they're not doing that every day.
No, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if someone's being vehement, it's like, okay, well then.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is respect. Mm. Like there's a difference between ego. Ego can get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Ego, there's nothing wrong with ego, but you know, ego is not always what's good for the song. It's
right.
about something else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
yeah. One other thing, as sort of a last question.
No, I'm not stopping.
You're not stopping. We're going to stay here for all afternoon.
I've loved this.
I'm glad you're enjoying it. Well, I mean, I read in an article, in an interview you did recently where you're talking about, I'm not sure if this is a quote or not, but you're talking about this is a trip down memory lane to give some words of wisdom to your 22-year-old self.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And the reason why that caught my attention is because I've been talking to a few of my musician friends about the strange emergence of seminars and summits and workshops and conferences and courses and all of these strange things that are coming up where people who are apparently experts are telling less experienced people, this is what you need to do to have a successful career in music.
Mm.
And the whole thing seems batty to me because it seems like a career that you can't possibly replicate. Like I could analyze your career, write it all out like a playbook, and then try to repeat it, and it won't work.
I don't know. It depends on what the seminar's about. Like, could I run a seminar about songwriting? I could. And the essence of it would be just follow your heart.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I do not know of these seminars you speak. but I think there is wisdom that can be shared. Like, if I was 19 again and Billie Holiday was still alive.
Yeah.
And she was going to do a seminar on singing. Man, I'd go.
Right.
I don't have, my voice sounds nothing like her, but can she teach me something? Yeah.
But that's a different thing.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Because that's about the actual technique of, so of, what of the skill.
So what are you talking about? Tell me.
Again, these follow-up questions. I'm just not used to them. I'm talking about...
Are these wannabes who don't really know and they're trying to pretend they don't?
It's about teaching career plans. This is what you need to do to be successful commercially or whatever.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I mean, one of the cheesy questions that I'm sure you've been asked many times in interviews is, what advice would you give to young musicians? But it just doesn't sit right with me that there are people who are putting on these workshops and courses telling kids what to do when I don't know if anyone really knows what to do. And I didn't expect this to I thought you would jump on this one.
No, because I think that the music industry and the arts in general are incredibly difficult places to find your feet,
yep.
to make a living, to find your way, and to stay in.
Yeah,
it is a place where you can be told so in so many different ways not to do it.
Mm.
And I think if you have a passion for it, then you seek anything that is kind of going to help you get there. And I think you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm. And if you're hungry for it and mum and dad are saying no or, you know, whatever, and there's a course saying, hey, I'll help you and you can go and learn a few things, I think I'd probably go.
Right.
You know, I think there's things to be learnt. I can understand why those seminars exist because it's just such a tricky place to be, isn't it? The arts is just fraught.
Yeah.
And I think if I'm hearing you right, you're saying it's all very unique and you follow your own path, and that is all true, but there's still going to be some... I can understand people wanting to latch onto something to help them stay in it.
Right.
To help give them hope, to help give them some kind of path that they could follow, to help give them some idea of where they could go. I can relate to that.
Yeah. So you have a more empathetic view on it.
Way more empathetic.
To me, it seems a little bit like a con.
I guess it depends on, well, that would be due diligence of the person who's going to do the course. Who are these people? Do they fucking know what they're talking about?
Right.
How much are they charging?
Yep.
What have people said about them? You know, if Billie Holiday's going to run a course, I'm going to go see her. If
that'd be a hilarious Julianne course.
Stenton is running a course. Who's Julianne Stenton? Mm. You know?
Yeah.
But if
Julianne Stenton?
I don't know. I'm just, who is she? She's some singer I've never heard of.
Right,
I'm
right.
making it up. Yeah. There's no one called Julianne Stenton. But if there's you know, an ex-manager who's managed a lot of New Zealand bands and they've got ideas for New Zealand bands.
Mm.
I think we're on different sides of that fence.
Yeah, maybe. So your comment about advice to your 22-year-old self, and I'm sure there's an interesting point of view there, but what if your 22-year-old self was around now? What advice would you give to your 22-year-old self if they were around now trying to make it?
Oh, well, it's the advice I do give my children.
Yeah.
Which is that this is the one regret I have about my career, is that I didn't ensure I was skilled in another way to give myself more financial freedom.
Right. Okay.
Because I've really made fuck all. I mean, honestly, if you look over the past 30 years of my career, I've maybe made $40,000.
Right. Out of the music.
whole entire time.
Yeah.
Let's make it 60
over
30 years.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a pretty common story too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a common story. So my son is very interested in film and he's a great musician. So I say this, people ask me a lot and I do say to them, for God's sake, just get something as well. I said, you know, don't stop what you're doing. Friggin' go for it.
Yeah.
But I wish I'd got I was interested in teaching. I wish I'd just sat down and kept doing what I was doing but got a teacher's degree.
Right.
Because then when I'm off in Europe or whatever and I'm touring, I can go do relief teaching. Yes. I can get jobs in between all this. And I haven't been able to do that. I mean, I've been lucky that I've done jingle singing and I've done voiceover work, a lot of voiceover work, but I've done a lot of retail work.
Yep.
And I was very fortunate with TV, you know, but I'm still struggling now with what I do, a bit of casting. I'm a casting director. That's great if you're fully employed in it all year. Well, I'm not fully employed in it all year.
Yeah.
So I'm not moaning.
No.
You know, I'm happy. Yeah. But that's the advice I give to people is, for God's sake, become an electrician.
Yeah.
Become a teacher. Become skilled in something.
Or at least diversify. Diversify within the field.
Do what you want to do. So I said to my boy, just do it. Just make sure you got that. And purely to give yourself more freedom as an artist.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it does. I'm not saying go get a normal job. I'm saying exactly the opposite.
Did you have normal jobs through the 80s and 90s and so on?
I worked in a bank as I was a bank clerk. I've done real estate for 18 months. Yep. I've worked in bookstores and record stores a lot through my time in the Headless Chickens. I had a great boss who would let me go off on tour whenever I wanted.
Awesome.
I taught the ukulele to adults and children. Mm-hmm.
Loved
teaching ukulele to babies. Loved.
Yeah. It's awesome.
A lot of retail, a lot of cafes and, you know, things like that. But retail does not pay well. That's the point.
That's right.
You know, if you're a relief teacher, you're probably making more than other teachers are.
Yeah.
If you're an electrician, you know, you're not getting $22 an hour.
Mm.
So that's my homely advice.
That's one of those reality wake-up calls, isn't it? I mean, often on the show, I've had people who have been really popular, big-named artists who have told the same story, you know, that the money wasn't what you think it was. And actually, they were struggling or they had other jobs or whatever, but the reality is just slightly different.
And really, do I care? I don't care. Am I that one of the happiest people on the planet because I was in the Headless Chickens and Straw People?
Yeah.
Am I musically 100% fulfilled?
Mm.
Yeah. Who gets to say that? Who gets to actually say, I followed my dream and I lived it and I'm friggin' happy?
Yep, absolutely.
I get to say that. And that is actually priceless.
Yes.
I just wish I'd made a bit more money. And I'm still going to blame Spotify.
I mean, I had a really positive thing happen to me in my early 20s where I was trying to work out how to become a full-time musician and I couldn't work it out. And everyone around me at the time was also trying to work it out. It was like we're trying to find the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
And then I was friends with this guy who was a bit older than me and he just casually mentioned one day, oh yeah, I went full-time like 6 months ago. And I went, what? How did you do that? And he went, oh, well, I just realized that you can't make enough money out of any one thing. So I just diversified. So now I do the original stuff. I do covers. He also did voiceover stuff. And he sang Cats Prefer Chef. You probably know him. His name's Chris Melville.
Oh, I know the name.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't know him.
I think he's well in the...
Cats same people. Prefer Chef.
He told me, and I'm like, fuck off. That's you? And then I heard it again, and it was totally him.
Yeah.
He just planted that seed in my mind. Like, don't think you're going to make enough money out of releasing original music, you know? And that's when I started to think, oh, yeah, that's a really good point. And so I started to work as a session musician and teach guitar lessons and do management stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
And I fixated on this idea of trying to have 5 streams of income. So if a couple of them dip, maybe the other two are doing okay and one's average.
How many streams have you got now?
Because
I worked on 4. One the other day. I worked on 16.
Oh my God.
I worked on 16, but I only had 13.
Right. Yeah. Probably 4 or 5 at the moment. But I kind of bundle a few things together and then call that one thing.
I unbundled mine.
Right, right. Yeah. Because if I think about like my work as a musician, I sort of stick all that together. But I mean, of course, I'm playing with lots of different people and things like that. So
I want to say for any musician who's out there listening, who thinks they want to do this, you should fucking do this.
Yes, that's great.
Yeah, because this has been one of the funnest times I've ever... I'm talking about this podcast.
Oh, you mean the podcast? I thought you meant a career.
No,
yeah,
this has been great.
Oh, thank you so much.
If you want me to record something for you to play down the line to people...
I think you just did.
Yeah, use it, because this has been absolutely great.
Oh,
you're
fantastic.
You're a great interviewer.
Thank you.
You covered great subjects. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, wow, that really means a lot. Thank you so much for saying that.
Awesome.
Yeah, and thank you for coming in and doing it.
Oh, I mean, no worries.
We've never met until now, so you took a chance on me, and I'm really grateful. Thank you.
No worries.
Thank you.
If you find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share and subscribe and give us a review on iTunes.